We've been talking about the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., the late civil rights and human rights leader. We want to turn now to another social justice advocate who has another perspective on human rights today. She says that bullying is a human rights issue. Her name is Carrie Kennedy. She is president of the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Justice and Human Rights. She's also the daughter of the organization's namesake, the late Robert F. Kennedy. The Robert F. Kennedy Center for Justice and Human Rights is known for raising awareness of human rights abuses around the world, and it typically deals with issues like genocide and environmental justice. But the organization recently decided to include school bullying as one of its areas of advocacy. And Carrie Kennedy is with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Now, you know, bullying is certainly something that we've come to understand is pervasive. The U.S. Department of Education says, now this is data from 2007, that about a third of students between the ages of 12 and 18 reported being bullied at school, which is one reason that last year the U.S. Department of Education held the first federally backed summit to address bullying in schools. But I'm wondering why you consider this a human rights issue, such that you would take it on, especially given your reputation for issues like genocide, as we said.
We have the Robert F. Kennedy Center's Speak Truth to Power curriculum, which is taught to about a million high school and middle school students worldwide. It's a 12-week course on human rights, and there are chapters on different human rights defenders and the work that they do. We wanted kids to really relate to this. We are asking them constantly to stand up against their peers when their peers are teasing or bullying others. So I thought that this was a very, very important lesson, not only because it's about bullying, but because our aim is really to get students to self-identify as human rights defenders. And if they can do it as teenagers, middle school and high school level, then I think our country will be better served and our world will be better served by them as they take on more and more positions of power.
You know, some might argue that this is a developmental issue. I mean, if there's something that's that pervasive, then it's something that you grow out of, as opposed to the other issues in human rights where you can't grow out of it. Like, you can't grow out of being a member of a minority group that's targeted for oppression. You can't grow out of, say, if you're a person who is gay and you're in a society that is hostile to you. That's not something you grow out of. And so I think there are people who would argue that bullying is different because that's part of childhood. It's something that has to be taught. People have to be taught out of it, that it's not the same. Could you address that?
Yeah, well, I think that's a myth. First of all, a lot of bully victims will never have a chance to grow out of being a victim because they will never grow up. They are 2 to 9 times more likely to consider suicide than non-victims. And, you know, 85% of bullying cases, there's no intervention or effort made by a teacher or administration. So this is something that all of us have a responsibility for. But I think in terms also of growing out of it, look at the statistic that says a bully is 6 times more likely to be incarcerated by the age of 24 and 5 times more likely to have a serious criminal record when they grow up. So these are people who often grow up to prey on our society.
I'm speaking with Carrie Kennedy. She's president of the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Justice and Human Rights. This is an organization that's known for its advocacy and raising awareness around issues like genocide. The organization is now adopted a new initiative to combat bullying in schools. And Carrie Kennedy is saying that we should think about bullying as another human rights issue. So talk to me, if you would, about this Speak Truth to Power curriculum. What kinds of lessons do you teach? Who do you teach it to? How does it work?
Well, the Speak Truth to Power curriculum is available online at rfkcenter.org. It's free. It's downloadable. And it's consistent with social studies and English curricula for 46 states. So almost anybody across the country can use it. Our aim there is to not only teach kids about the particular issue, in this case bullying, but also give them concrete tools that they can use so that they can become human rights defenders at the end of this 12-week curriculum. So, for instance, we teach kids to recognize what bullying is. In the last month, have you heard certain words, offensive words, in your school? Every time we ask that, half the room will raise their hands. And does that make you feel safe? Do you think every kid who comes to this school feels safe each day? And, you know, we find across the board, nobody raises their hands because everybody knows that kids in their school are not feeling safe. So the question is, what are we as adults going to do about that? And this curriculum really teaches kids that they can rely on the administration, they can rely on their parents, but they can also take action themselves to stop bullying and to protect themselves and to create an environment that's safe in their schools.
How do you recommend that, particularly the adults in a situation, separate bullying from the give and take that students, particularly older students, should be allowed to have? Like, for example, if you have students who have different perspectives on sexual orientation, maybe students from a particular religious background who believe that same-sex relationships are wrong and shouldn't be sanctioned and are in the same community with people who feel differently. I mean, how do you keep from making it be politically correct, you know, or just policing speech right to the point where people really can't talk about the things that they want to talk about?
Yeah, absolutely fine to disagree on the issues. What you're not allowed to do is start calling people names or doing so in a way that's meant to cause harm. There are things that adults need to do and can do. One is to help kids identify what bullying is. Two, you can know who to call and when to call. So teachers should be told, administrators should be told. If the administration is not taking steps, you can go to the district level, to the state level.
How do you think bullies should be dealt with? Does the RFK Center for Human Rights have a perspective on policies of how bullies should be dealt with? And I'm particularly interested in the fact that a number of communities, after having experienced, you know, tragedies around bullying, have sometimes turned to, you know, stiffening penalties, which sometimes includes incarceration if kids are of a certain age. But the U.S. already has an extremely high rate of incarceration when compared to other countries, and it does seem that certain groups, particularly minority groups, seem to be the ones on whom this falls most heavily. So what is your perspective on
right
how bullies should be dealt with?
Well, in, you know, if people are breaking law, they have to be held responsible. So let's start there. That said, criminalization, punishment really rarely works with bullying. In fact, most people who are bullies are people who have been abused in one way or the other in some other part of their life. And somebody who is bullied at school might come home and bully their younger siblings or their cousins or other people in their neighborhood or in cyberspace. So it's a little bit more complex than identifying one person as the perpetrator and punishing that person.
Finally, before we let you go, when you think about, you know, where we are now, and if you and I were to get together, say, 5 years from now and talk about this, what kind of conversation do you think, you know, we'll have?
I think that it's very positive that the federal government, the Obama administration, has taken a strong stance on this, and there's increasing understanding, recognition of it, and school districts are dealing with it, grappling with it in a way that they really haven't in the past. And that's, I think, particularly appropriate as we're celebrating Martin Luther King Day today, to think about who are the groups of people who are being discriminated against and ostracized because of something about them over which they have no control. And what are we doing to address that as a community? And that's what bullying education is about. And I think 5 years from now, this is going to be a much more widely understood phenomenon. And I think we're going to have better tools in our toolkit to address it.
Carrie Kennedy is the president of the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Justice and Human Rights. She was kind enough to join us on this Martin Luther King Day from our studios in New York. Carrie Kennedy, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The nation's law schools are facing growing pressure to be more upfront about their graduates' job prospects. Many former students say they were lured by juicy job numbers, but when they got out, all they ended up with was massive debt. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, the American Bar Association is cracking down, but too late for many.
Chloe Gilgan enrolled at New York Law School in 2005 with one thing in mind, getting a good-paying job. She says the school gave her every assurance that she was in the right place.
A high majority of their graduates would find employment at least within 9 months of graduating, and that they tended to have three-figure salaries.
3 years after graduation, Chloe Gilgan says the only three-figure number she's staring at is her student debt. The only job she found was doing work that did not require a law degree. Gilgan is convinced New York law twisted its job numbers.
Nobody can guarantee you'll have a job for sure, but what they can do is give you honest prospects.
So Chloe Gilgan has joined a proposed class action lawsuit against New York Law School, charging that it has deceived students. Attorney David Anziska is lining up plaintiffs who attended primarily lower-tier law schools, paid more than $40,000 a year, and feel they got little in return.
When you're taking out such staggering amount of debt, you want to make sure that you have a job at the end of the day, that you'll be able to pay back your loans and pay your bills.
New York Law School says it provides all the information required by the American Bar Association and more. Carol Buckler is interim dean. She says the school tries hard to counsel students about their employment prospects.
We also break down the information based on the type of employer and the salaries that graduates might expect.
But in blogs like The Law School Scam, former students howl about high tuition and lousy job prospects. And there's Kyle McEntee, who started lawschooltransparency.com. McEntee says he was outraged to find that the employment data supplied by many lower-tier schools is really part of a recruiting strategy.
And so a school might advertise a median salary of $160,000 and not disclose that only 10% of the class actually responded to the salary survey.
Or McEntee says schools don't disclose that some jobs are in fact funded by the law school. McEntee himself is a graduate of Vanderbilt Law, where he says he actually got good employment information when he enrolled. Elizabeth Workman, assistant dean for career services at Vanderbilt, says she keeps a close eye on students' achievement and their debt.
And if they will incur six figures in terms of debt, we have a very serious discussion about employment outcomes.
Activists say more schools need to follow that path. They blame the American Bar Association, which accredits law schools, for letting institutions decide what is accurate. The ABA's John O'Brien admits this has been a problem.
The definition of accurate has largely been left to the schools.
So recently, the ABA changed the rules. Starting next year, schools will have to report whether graduates are employed full-time, whether the positions graduates get require a law degree. That will help applicants in the future decide if they're picking a law school that is turning out employable lawyers. But John O'Brien says it's still up to students to scrutinize that data because the ABA can only demand transparency.
The schools are simply required to report. We do not have minimum standards for employment.
Kyle McEntee of lawschooltransparency.com says the ABA changes are a good first step, but they won't help students already in school. And these measures don't address larger issues. Why is law school enrollment continuing to rise when the job market is shrinking in many areas? The legal sector shed 1,800 jobs in December, according to the Labor Department. Kyle McEntee says the biggest challenge is battling a perception of invulnerability.
There's a culturally embedded view about law school, that it's this magic ticket to financial security. And as it turns out, this isn't the case, and it hasn't been the case for quite some time.
When critics attacked for-profit colleges for similar problems, the Department of Education tightened regulations on those schools. But the department says it has no authority to do the same to the vast majority of law programs. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Block. Penn State President Rodney Erickson has spent the past few days getting grilled by alumni. More than 2 months after a child sex abuse scandal upended the university, alums are angry. But their focus is not so much the alleged crimes. Instead, it's how administrators have dealt with the scandal, specifically their decision to fire longtime football coach Joe Paterno. Last night, Erickson met with Penn State alumni in suburban Philadelphia, and NPR's Jeff Brady was there.
Just days after child sex abuse charges were filed against retired assistant coach Jerry Sandusky, the Board of Trustees fired football coach Joe Paterno and the school president. That's when Rodney Erickson took the helm. Last night in a hotel meeting room before a crowd of about 600 alumni, Erickson laid out an overriding goal for his tenure.
I will not allow this great university and its long and historic legacy as a leader in higher education to be defined by this horrible tragedy.
While a strong statement, that was not one of the applause lines of the evening. Here's Penn State alum Beth Wells.
Why did the board fire Joe Paterno prior to conducting an internal investigation?
President Erickson referred questions about Paterno's firing to the Board of Trustees, which issued a statement Thursday. It said trustees unanimously decided letting the coach go was in the best interest of the university. That didn't go over well at another meeting in the same hotel last night. Downstairs, a group of alumni who want to get rid of the entire Board of Trustees held a competing conversation. Former Penn State and pro football player Franco Harris responded to the board's statement that it acted in the best interest of the university.
Do they think that we are that dumb? That's exactly what they said 2 months ago, and they still want us to swallow that.
Harris is a legendary Pittsburgh Steelers running back who played in the 1970s and early 80s. It didn't take long for someone in the audience to suggest he campaign for a seat on Penn State's Board of Trustees.
Okay, now, you know my running days are over.
Back upstairs in the official meeting, 1982 graduate Anthony Lebrano chastised President Erickson for not issuing an apology to former coach Paterno.
You haven't even yet called the man. There has been no one from this university, no one in an administrative capacity, call Coach Paterno. Coach Bill O'Brien called him Monday night, and he's only been with us a couple of days.
Much of the discussion centered on the firing of Paterno and how the scandal has harmed Penn State's reputation. At one point, President Erickson steered the conversation toward the 10 alleged victims.
There's some things that happened here, if true, we need to take responsibility for. If there are victims, by God, we need to do right by them. We need to see that they get justice.
Penn State alumni raised more than $500,000 to help victims of sexual assault in the weeks after the scandal broke. 2 months on, many of them are now focusing their anger on how the school's leadership treated Joe Paterno. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Philadelphia.
To a new trend now in high-tech hiring. Hands-on computer skills are an important asset for many, if not most, job seekers in today's economy. But Harvest Public Media's Clay Masters reports that some companies are starting to look a bit broader, filling IT jobs with some unlikely college grads.
Remember that old joke about how a liberal arts major says hello? You know, you want fries with that? Well, that joke might be turning on those who still use it. Consider that Healthy Choice frozen meal you toss into the microwave. There's a lot that goes on behind it. I'm not talking about the physical production of that convenient lunch, but just the way you even know about it, how it gets to the aisle of your local grocery store in the first place.
Think of what it takes to produce a product, what it takes to run a factory, what it takes to run a payroll. All of these business processes ultimately are reduced to some form of computer logic.
That's Garrett Schutte. He's chief information officer at Omaha-based food company ConAgra. It's the giant behind brands like Healthy Choice and Slim Jim. And like in any company, behind all of its business operations is its information technology department, which is recruiting more employees off the beaten path. The IT department here is huge, about 700 employees. There are no assigned workspaces. One day a week, employees work remotely from home. In 2008, the company revamped its IT internship program to include those who didn't climb the traditional techie ladder, like Eric Fossey, who majored in communication studies.
That initial interview that I had was just going over the skills. And so, you know, they're trying to get a beat on what is your IT background. So they're asking me, do you not do JavaScript? Do you not? And I had to say no to everything. And I thought, oh, I'm sunk. Like, there's no way. I was like, I'm not going to get a call back.
Fossey didn't just get a call back. He eventually got an IT job at ConAgra. So did Holly Barber, even though on paper her resume may have seemed a bit thin.
So all throughout high school, I was definitely kind of a geek and a gamer. So I was kind of naturally leaning towards computer science, but I didn't like math. So that was kind of the stumbling block for me eventually. So I became a computer science major, but then switched to journalism.
The company partners with nearby colleges to grow their own local talent, like Fossey and Barber, right here in Omaha, while still hiring those students who take the normal computer science route. Again, ConAgra Chief Information Officer Garrett Chute.
We look for them to have more than a single dimension in terms of what they bring to the table. Just technical talent is not enough.
Deborah Humphreys is with the Association of American Colleges and Universities, an organization that acts as an intermediary between colleges and businesses, making sure graduates are prepared for the demands of the rapidly changing workplace. Humphreys also names Siemens and Hewlett-Packard as companies open to non-traditional hiring.
The big message for today's college students is to remember that they're preparing now for a lifetime of work, not just for that first job they're going to get right as they graduate. And what we're hearing from employers over and over again is that students really need a combination of broad skills and abilities that you get from a really good college education.
So while no one's saying computer science majors won't still be in high demand, it does appear that having some, dare I say, liberal arts training while embracing your inner computer geek might just be the key to getting your foot in the door. For NPR News, I'm Clay Masters in Omaha.